the title.
And so I'm going to try and paint a picture of how this relates to maybe some things you might know about in cosmology, and then the implications this might have for just outside the formal aspect of identifying degrees of freedom. But just to back up, so to put a little perspective, why would we want extra dimensions? One reason we might want extra dimensions is hierarchy problem, a possible solution to that. There's two different ways we could do that, or to use extra dimensions to solve the hierarchy problem. Solve or push it back. One way is to use large or flat extra dimensions. And there you use the largeness of the extra dimensions to dilute the fundamental scale of gravity down to the TeV scale. Hence, as we actually heard yesterday in Veronica's lecture, this sets the fundamental scale at the TeV, so there's no hierarchy problem. Although you still have a largeness problem in why is the volume that large. Another approach that you could take is to have warped extra dimensions. So this is a different approach in where your extra dimensions aren't large, but instead you have for instance, for a five-dimensional metric, you have a four-dimensional piece and an extra-dimensional piece. And the four-dimensional piece has a factor out front, which depends on the position in the internal space, commonly called a warp factor, hence the name of the warp extra dimensions. And here, in this model, the fundamental scale of gravity depends on where you are in the extra dimensions. And so if you're at a place where this quantity is very small, then the fundamental scale of gravity can be around the TeV. And then this can also help you solve the hierarchy problem. Or more generally, extra dimensions just show up. And so we should figure out what to do with them. If you want to study four-dimensional physics or lower-dimensional physics, physics that doesn't that's not purely the higher dimension, we should figure out what to do with extra dimensions, how to describe the degrees of freedom of these models. So how do we describe models with extra dimensions? Well, a cartoonish way of how we might do this is the following. You start in higher dimensions, and you turn on various ingredients. For instance, in supergravities in higher dimensions, you have gauge fields and you have localized sources like D-brains and P-form fields. So you can turn on various things in the higher dimensions. So you have various fields in higher dimensions. You put them through the funnel of compactification, essentially integrating out all information about the extra dimensions and only keeping information about the dimensions you're interested in. And you end up with some subclass of four-dimensional effective theories where you just study dynamics. And so you study things like inflation or De Sitter space on these types of models. So a common example that will come up a lot and we'll talk about a lot is in virtually every model of extra dimensions, you have two universal, what are called universal moduli, two universal scalar fields. One of them corresponds to the volume modulus. The volume modulus is a field which multiplies the internal extra dimensions metric, and so it just acts as a rescaling factor for the internal metric. There's another scalar field that shows up a lot. So oftentimes in these models, you have some bulk scalar field, some scalar field that lives in the higher dimensions. And so you might want to also study fluctuations of that one. And so you have some scalar field which has some VeV and some fluctuation. And so if you put this through the machinery of compactification, you end up with some effective field theory in four dimensions, which schematically might look something like this. You have some kinetic terms, and you have some effective potential. Okay. Let me zoom in on that and just show you an example of what you might do with this. So why am I interested in these two universal moduli, and what might I do with an effective theory like this? Well, an effective theory for something like this, in type 2A string theory, the effective potential might look something like this. So this looks like some complicated expression. There's two, the fields here are rho and delta phi. I've just redefined delta phi and rho into some other convenient parameter called tau. So the fields here are rho and tau. And everything else here is some number, some microphysical number that I put in. So this is some two-field effective potential that I have for my fields rho and my field tau. And you can study, for instance, De Sitter vacua or inflation on something like this. And many people have done this. So, for example, turn on everything except this term, which has to do with the curvature of the internal space. So you have zero internal curvature, so you take your space to be like a torus, your extra dimensions to be a torus. Then you get an effective potential that looks something like this, which has an ADS minimum, and you wouldn't necessarily like that for cosmology because we like to live in worlds with either zero or positive cosmological constant. But nonetheless, you have an effective potential, you can study this. You can imagine changing parameters in this effective action or an effective potential. For instance, allow positive curvature, like a sphere, so your internal space is a sphere. You get a contribution to your effective potential as this red dotted line, so it doesn't change that you get an anti-de Sitter vacuum, but you still, it shifts the minimum, and so you get something different. However, if you allow a negative internal curvature, you get a new contribution, which is this red dashed line. And this can uplift what you had previously for flat space or flat internal curvature to something that might look like this, where now this could be Minkowski or de Sitter space. So you can study questions like these. Can you get de Sitter space from these constructions? Yeah, right. The way I've chosen my definition of the moduli, I don't. So actually, on the previous page, it was somewhat of a cheat. I wrote the kinetic term in terms of rho and delta phi. Actually, in terms of rho and delta phi, there was a kinetic mixing. In terms of rho and tau, which is actually why I redefined it this way, there is no kinetic mixing. I don't know if that's related to why you were asking that question. Okay, so these are the types of things I might want to ask with these effective theories from compactification. So now I want to step back and ask, how do I construct these effective actions more realistically? What I've just shown you is actually a very toy picture. One thing that I might worry about in constructing that effective theory is that I actually cheated a lot. And just working with the four-dimensional effective action, I've integrated out the extra dimensions, so there may be things I missed. What you might say, what could you possibly miss? The minima of the effective potential are just Einstein equations and the dilaton equation of motion. And the minimum of the effective potential is just the external Einstein equation. What could possibly go wrong in a construction like this? Your four-dimensional effective action equations are the same as your high-dimensional action equations. But it's not entirely true. There are things that are missed in a construction like this. For instance, there are off-diagonal Einstein equations, which don't arise at all from a four-dimensional effective action. They cannot be derived from a four-dimensional effective action. Also, in writing down my four-dimensional effective action, I've essentially forgotten about the fact that I had d-dimensional gravity, 10-dimensional gravity. So I have diffeomorphisms associated with 10-dimensional gravity. Is that something important? I've essentially dropped all that information. I should take that into account, and I should be worried that I'm doing things in a covariant way at the end of the day. But more generally, I'm interested in what would dynamics look like in a model with extra dimensions? Not just at the four-dimensional level, but what would it look like at the higher dimensional level? Can I study that at the higher dimensional level without projecting out the interesting higher dimensional physics? And so that's the type of question I want to ask. I want to ask questions about dynamics at the level of the higher dimensions. And one reason that I'll come to at the end of the talk is that may give me some really interesting features for cosmology, but I'll kind of speculate on that at the end. So let me give you an outline for the rest of the talk. So I said I want to study dynamics in extra dimensions, but it turns out the dynamics are very closely related to something that's well known, which is cosmological perturbation theory, dynamics in cosmological backgrounds. So because of this, I want to first review the formalism of cosmological perturbation theory. And then essentially I'm going to do a relabeling for spaces with extra dimensions and study perturbation theory in warped spaces with extra dimensions. And find what the degrees of freedom are and what perturbations look like. I'll give you an example, because that'll be fairly abstract at that point. I'll give you an example of what these perturbations might look like in a class of backgrounds called P-brain backgrounds. Then I wanted to touch on some other side topics near the end about how the weakly warped limit is not the same as the unwarped limit, as people commonly do in these models. and give you some other examples of the general phenomenon that I'll discuss about how perturbations combine into gauge-invariant perturbations. And at the end, I'll speculate about some cosmological applications. So first, let's review cosmological perturbation theory. And so our Psi students will have this fresh in your mind of what this looks like. So let me say I have some four-dimensional cosmological background with a homogeneous scalar field. So I have a metric that looks like the FRW metric. So I have a scale factor. And I have some scalar field which has which is homogeneous but depends on time. Okay. So let me look at this and take constant time slices of this space. And constant time slices, so here's time, here's space. Constant time slices are also constant phi slices. The phi is homogeneous, so that's what I mean by the homogeneous mode. But I can imagine putting a perturbation on top of this homogeneous mode. And so if I put a perturbation on top of this homogeneous mode, given by this dotted line, a dashed line here, well, now constant time slices are not constant phi slices. Constant time slices have phi depending on space. Okay, that's what you'd expect. Except there's a caveat, which is that that's not strictly true. That statement doesn't really even make sense. It's not a gauge-invariant statement. I can always make a coordinate redefinition such that in the new coordinate system, constant time slices are constant phi slices. So I can always choose a diffeomorphism or a coordinate redefinition. Time goes to time plus some function of time and space. Under this time translation, or sorry, this time redefinition, then I get my original background scalar field, and I get a term like this, and then I have my fluctuation. But you can always choose an appropriate new coordinate so that my effective fluctuation vanishes. And so I'm just left with the homogeneous mode. This is what I said before. The constant time slices in the new coordinate system are constant phi slices. So the fluctuation was a fake. I can gauge it away. I can do a diffeomorphism and remove the fluctuations by coordinate transformations. Except it's not completely a fake, because now the fluctuation went somewhere else. In making this coordinate redefinition, it shows up in the metric. So what I should really do is consider the set of all possible perturbations of the metric and the scalar together. So let's do that. The general set of scalar perturbations of the metric and the scalar would look something like this. So I have a perturbation in my time, perturbation in my spatial component, I have a longitudinal piece of the graviton, and I have a mixing term, an off-diagonal mixing term, in addition to my usual scalar field fluctuation. So I have five scalar functions that I can write down in general. Okay, but not all five of these scalar functions are independent, because as I just said, I can do diffeomorphisms or gauge transformations. I can get rid of this one and shift it over here. Or alternatively, all of these fields transform under the diffeomorphisms, but some combinations of them don't. And it turns out there's three linearly independent combinations that you can construct that are gauge invariant, that don't transform under the gauge transformations. The sub B is because these are usual Bardeen variables. And so they're combinations of these fields, the scalar functions that I showed up above. And it turns out that since there's three, there were two diffeomorphisms that I was allowed to do given the symmetries of my construction, and so I'm left with three variables left over. And one thing I want to point out here is that the gauge-invariant scalar field fluctuation is a mixture of the original scalar fluctuation and some metric fluctuations. That's important. And the gauge-invariant one, it has to be a mixture. So I have these three gauge-invariant variables, but it turns out not all of them are actually independent. They have to satisfy Einstein's equations, in particular the constraint equations of Einstein equations, which are algebraic equations. They're not dynamical equations. So I have to solve them for all time. And so the constraint equations of Einstein's equations are the usual momentum and Hamiltonian constraint equations, the G0 mu equations. And so there are some equations which impose algebraic constraints on my gauge-invariant fields. And so there's two of them, two independent ones here. And so I started with five. I lost two to diffeomorphisms, two to the constraint equations. So I'm left with a single independent gauge invariant degree of freedom, which I can call, for instance, I can identify as a curvature perturbation or other types of convenient characterizations. And the important thing that I wanted to point out here, which is going to be important for the next section, is that this gauge invariant degree of freedom is some mixture of the scalar field and the metric fluctuations. Okay. So that's it. Yes? All right, so you guys are special though, right? Because you're visiting. Okay, so I guess it's unfair to put them on the spot for that, right? Okay. Okay. Good. But Ruth, was it Ruth that in principle covered this or no?
Okay. I would think Nathan would have
done it,
but
no. Oh yeah, yeah.
Okay.
That's what you did in exploration.
Oh. Yeah,
that's what you did. Okay.
Okay. Okay. Okay. So it'll come up in exploration. Okay. Okay. So now let me move on to the next section. So warp perturbation theory. So let's do this same story except with perturbations in extra dimensions. So let me start with my background. So I have a background of d dimensions. So I have some space time. I'm going to leave things fairly general. Just some p plus one dimensional space time. You should have in your mind that's four dimensional though. And I have some extra dimensional space. And I also have these warp factors up front. Most generally, the most general compactification will have these warp factors up front. So this will depend on the internal space. This one's just convenient, so I can just reabsorb it into the internal metric. And I also have some scalar field, which will have some profile that depends on the internal space. And this is just some solution someone hands you. There's a large number of these of known types of solutions that people can hand you. And so this is just some solution that someone's going to hand you. I'm going to give you a specific example of exactly this solution in a little bit. But right now I'm just going to be fairly general. And so as I said, generically this solution is warped. So generically you have these warp factors here that depend on the internal space. It's important that they depend on the internal space. This is the analog of, in cosmological perturbation theory, having a scale factor which depends on time and having a scalar field which depends on time. So these things depend on the internal space. Okay. Let me do a similar analysis. I have a homogeneous mode, the VEV, and so on the homogeneous mode, constant slices in Y in the internal directions are constant slices in phi. But I can also put a perturbation on top of this, or fluctuation, where fluctuations now, constant slices in internal space are not constant phi slices. And they depend on space-time. But again, that is not a gauge invariant statement. That statement doesn't really make sense. I can always perform a coordinate redefinition of my internal space. So I can perform a coordinate redefinition such that now constant y slices are constant phi slices, just as I did in the cosmological case. Formally, it would look something like this. I perform a redefinition of my y-coordinate, and I can always reabsorb my fluctuation by an appropriate choice of a diffeomorphism so that I'm left with just background. That I can always do. But as before, that means I've pushed the degrees of freedom into the metric. Okay, so what I should really be doing is studying perturbations about the metric and scalar field system together. So now let me write down the most general set of perturbations that are scalar fields in the lower dimensions with respect to the metric, perturbations in the metric and the scalar field. So it looks something like this, very similar to what I had before. I have a field that's overall scaling factor for the internal metric. I have a longitudinal mode here. I have some mixing term between the external and the internal spaces. And I also have a perturbation of the internal space. And so none of these indices or none of these fluctuations carry space-time indices. They're all scalars with respect to space-time, but they're definitely not scalars with respect to the internal space. And I also have the fluctuation of the scalar field. And so I have some number of scalar functions that parameterize the most general ansatz I can write down. Fine. But not all of these are gauge invariant. So I need to come up with a gauge invariant combination just as I did before. So what are the gauge invariant variables? Well, just find the combinations that of the gauge transformations such that these things don't transform. And so there's certain combinations that you can construct that look particularly ugly in some ways. But nonetheless, so there's gauge invariant variables, and these are the exact analogs of what I had previously in the cosmological case. And the diffeomorphisms, so they just removed d degrees of freedom because I had d diffeomorphisms. Sorry, n diffeomorphisms. That's a typo. N diffeomorphisms that I was allowed to do. Okay. So another thing I wanted to point out, just as before, is that my gauge invariant dilaton fluctuation is my original dilaton fluctuation plus the perturbation of the metric, some fluctuation of the metric. So it has to combine with some fluctuation of the metric. Okay. But as before, actually not all of these fluctuations are independent. They also have to satisfy the Einstein constraint equations. So I have a set of constraint equations on my gauge invariant variables that are time independent. Sorry, not time independent. They have to be satisfied for all time. They're not dynamical equations. And so they just impose some constraints on my variables, which in the cosmological, or in this case, looks particularly ugly. But nonetheless, they remove another set of degrees of freedom. And so I'm left with some number of independent gauge invariant degrees of freedom. Yeah.
Or G plus one dimensions is Minkowski, or does that matter?
Good question. I didn't tell you that when I wrote down my background. I'm assuming that it's some. Let me go back a step. I'm assuming that this G hat is some maximally symmetric space. So it could be Minkowski, De Sitter, or Antikythera. But you could rightfully ask how, you know, do you actually know how to construct a De Sitter space? Some exact solution for De Sitter space? No, not necessarily. But that's actually a really interesting question. But nonetheless, some Minkowski, De Sitter, the details of that, just as long as it's maximally symmetric, doesn't matter.
So it doesn't carry through itself to FRW, I assume.
That's right. Okay. That's right. That's not FRW. Right. So the cosmological version of this would be very interesting.
So where did you make that assumption? Can you go to the slide where you define the perturbations?
So I didn't make it here. It wasn't necessary to go here. And it actually wasn't necessary here. The place where it was necessary is when writing down these constraint equations, to say that this constraint equation, for instance, is just purely this one, as opposed to something also coming from having a non-Einstein external space. So otherwise, it would have also had a term that's like proportional to just the dynamics of that space. That's where that assumption came in. It's actually not really an essential assumption, but to make everything clean. Okay, one thing I want to point out is that it's actually inconsistent to just turn on the dilaton fluctuation. So say turn off all the scalar metric fluctuation, just turn on the dilaton fluctuation, it contributes to the energy momentum tensor through a term that looks like this, and that has to be zero, but that obviously can't be zero if the dilaton has a background profile. If the dilaton does not have a profile that depends on the internal space, it's fine. But if the dilaton has a profile, as it does for virtually every background, then you have to have, or then this is not consistent. So it has to combine with some metric fluctuation in order to create a consistent degree of freedom. So the open question, or the question here, is what fluctuation in the metric could that actually be? So let me first, rather than try and argue for this in general, let me present an intuitive argument based on the cosmological case, and then give you an exact example where you'll see this. So what fluctuation can this be? Well, in the cosmological case, what happened? The scalar field fluctuation, the background plus the fluctuation, it mixed with a particular perturbation of the metric, the curvature perturbation. And so this perturbation of the internal, of the spatial directions. So it shows up as an overall rescaling of the spatial directions. Okay. These are the things that actually share the dynamics or the degrees of freedom. These are the things that have kinetic terms, for instance. The other fluctuations just show up as necessary to solve constraint equations. Okay, so you can ask a similar question in the cosmological case, in the extra dimensional case, and you get a similar answer, or rather using this intuition, you can say, what should it combine with? Well, it should combine with the overall rescaling mode of the internal space, just as in the cosmological case. So this was the thing we called the volume modulus before. So this mode will have a kinetic term, and so will the standard dual-tom fluctuation, but it's inconsistent to turn on both, or either one independently of the other. They actually both combine into just one degree of freedom, just as in the cosmological case. This curvature perturbation and the scalar field fluctuation combine into a single degree of freedom. This actually is a little bit of a cheat. You need to generalize what you mean by a volume modulus. You can't just write it as an overall rescaling like this. It ends up being slightly messier, but nonetheless, such an object, such a beast exists of what you mean by a volume modulus in a warped space. And so you can write that down, and we'll see that in a second. But one thing I want to point out is that actually none of this is new. This is actually at least 10 years old. People had seen this already in Randall-Sundrum contexts, where the Goldberger-Wise scalar field combines with the radion to create one single degree of freedom. They're not. You would have thought they were two independent degrees of freedom because they came from two separate fields in the five dimensions, but they combine just a one single degree of freedom in lower dimensions. So this is an old story. Essentially, I took five and changed five to n for n dimensions. And so in a slightly trivial way, that's all that's really going on here. But let me give you a specific example so you can see what this looks like, in particular, these backgrounds of P brains. Okay, so what do I start with for my matter? Well, let me start in D dimensions. So I have the D-dimensional Ricci scalar. I have this bulk scalar field calling the dilaton. And now I'm going to throw in a p-form field, well, a p plus 2, where little p will be the number of space dimensions that I have. And I also imagine I'll have some localized source, like a d-brain. OK, so there are solutions to this matter content, which look like the following. They're called p-brain solutions, so they have a warp factor. I have a p plus 1 dimensional space, some other complicated looking warp factor, and an internal space. And this internal space I'm taking to be flat, like a torus right now. The dilaton phi has a profile which depends on the internal space. And the gauge potential, Cp plus 1, this is just going to be going along for the ride. It's not going to be that important. But it also has a profile which depends on the internal space, the volume point. This warp factor actually has a special property in that it's a harmonic function. So nabla squared of the internal space on it, on some combination, e to the minus 2 gamma, where gamma is some numerical constant, is 0 except at certain locations, except at delta function sources. So these are the localized sources that I put in that source this warp factor. So it's harmonic away from those points. The nice thing about that is that means this warp factor has a shift invariance. I can take it and shift by a constant, and that's always still a solution. I can imagine actually making that shift space-time dependent, turning that into a space-time dependent mode, some physical degree of freedom. And in fact, that's exactly what we'll do for what I'm going to call this breathing mode, for this combination of the dilaton fluctuation and the volume modulus. So let me say I take this warp factor, and I define it as my background, plus some space-time-dependent shift. The space-time-dependent shift, well, that gets killed by the internal nabla too, so this is still a harmonic function. So that's fine. Question? Yes. Yeah, so C, dc, the external exterior derivative of C is f. Okay, so that's almost true. I have to turn on a bunch of other things, a bunch of other fields in the metric, which make things look particularly ugly. But let me just parse this for you. So I have this field U of X. And this field U of X shows up in the warp factor A. And so it shows up in the dilaton fluctuation. So this field U of X controls the dilaton fluctuation. Okay. But it also controls a metric fluctuation. In particular, this particular metric fluctuation here, this combination of the warp factors appearing right here with this factor U of X, is exactly what you would have done for a volume modulus, but if the space had been warped rather than unwarped. If you take the unwarped limit or weakly warped limit of this, you'll get exactly the standard definition of the volume modulus. And this is still just an overall rescaling factor. U of x is just overall rescaling the internal space. So this is just a volume modulus fluctuation. So this single degree of freedom is controlling both dilaton fluctuation and a volume modulus fluctuation. This is exactly what I was saying before on what I expected to happen. I should expect the single degree of freedom to control both the dilaton fluctuation and a volume modulus. Okay. So this is important because it says that what I did at the beginning of the talk, writing down this effective action and this effective theory for two degrees of freedom, tau and rho, or delta phi and rho, it was completely wrong. I treated those as two independent degrees of freedom. I could turn on one without turning on the other. That's not true. They're actually a single degree of freedom. They both combine to become a single degree of freedom. Now, I had not seen that at the level of the four-dimensional effective theory. I had to be very careful in doing the dimensional reduction and studying the theory at the level of the higher dimensions to see that. Now, of course, if I had just done the dimensional reduction correctly from the beginning, there would have never been a problem with my four-dimensional effective theory. But the point here is, I have to take a step back and be a little bit more careful about what we mean by the true degrees of freedom. We want to make sure that they're gauge invariant and they're independent. No, not at all. Not at all. Exactly. Yeah, and I want to make it clear, I'm not talking about kinetic mixing. These two fields are actually combining into one. So rho and delta phi are both dependent on a single field, for instance. That's right. Yeah, but I just wanted to make sure that that's clear. I'm not just doing a field rotation.
Gauge transformation in NV, what does it mean in 4D? Is it some kind of nonlinear?
What it's doing is it's combining, actually removing putative degrees of freedom. Degrees of freedom you thought you had. It's just removing them. It's something that's projecting out degrees of freedom. Same thing with the constraint equations. It's something you impose like at the level of a Lagrange multiplier, right? It's just projecting out degrees of freedom.
But if I gauge fix in D,
yeah.
I mean the point is I could just write a theory for rho or a theory for tau.
You could.
I cannot write a theory for, but then I guess choosing tau or rho is just a change of variable. I mean I'm just
no. What I'm saying, okay. So I would say if you just tried to turn on rho, you could write down a four-dimensional effective theory for that. Mm-hmm. Would look perfectly fine. If you try to study the Einstein equations at the higher dimensional level, so these constraint equations, for instance, you'll find that they're just not satisfied. So it's not a solution.
So a gauge fix in D dimensions, so I have to write that. Work with the gauge invariant variable always.
No, not necessarily. So in fact, when we do cosmological perturbation theory, we often don't work with gauge invariant variable for gauge fix. Mm-hmm. But you have to do a correct gauge fix.
Right.
I mean, if you over gauge fix, so you can't solve the equations of motion, then you over gauge fix. You were over constrained.
So let's do the correct gauge fixing.
Yeah, so this is a gauge fixing, for instance. I can always choose a different gauge where I choose a different internal coordinate, and I can push this entire dilaton fluctuation into the metric. It'll look really, really ugly. I can do that. You wouldn't really want to solve the system that way. But yeah, you can choose that gauge, or you can choose this gauge. This is a gauge fix. I'm not working with gauge invariant variables here.
Okay, so then my question is,
yeah, good.
Different gauge fix.
Yeah.
4D theory where I choose different gauge and I already.
Yeah.
How do I relate these two 4D theory? What's the symmetry?
No, clearly they're the same thing. Though if you do the dimensional reduction, they'll give you the exact same kinetic terms, exact same effective theory. Yeah, at the level of the four-dimensional effective theory, you're not doing anything. All you're doing is reshuffling things at the 10-dimensional level. Right? Yeah, okay.
I came in late thinking, yeah. Can you say what topology or what metric for the internal space you're using?
For this particular p-grain example, I'm taking the internal space to be flat, so like a torus. In general, it's not necessary as long as I actually have a solution, a background solution.
I see. And you have a grain in this. So we're not a quotient of that. We're actually living on a grain within the higher dimensional space-time.
For instance, we could be living on a three-grain. Okay, so a three-grain happens to be a bad example. Because for a three-grain, it turns out you don't get a dilaton profile. That's the one case where there, you know, a three-brain in a 10-dimensional space, excuse me, that you don't get a Dilthey profile. So that's like the one counterexample. But say we're on a five-brain, and the five-brain itself wraps a cycle.
I see. Because in the more traditional Kaluza Klein one, where we're just a quotient, when there's no brain, then usually some sort of argument, of symmetry argument, tells you that you don't lose anything by doing the naive dimensional reduction.
Well, yeah.
Is it because the brain, is it the role of the brain that's making this new subtlety?
No. So actually, you could do the exact same wrong thing with the Kaluza-Klein dimensional reduction. So, for instance, you could do a dimensional reduction of Kaluza-Klein theory on an S1, for instance,
right.
Where you just turn on the gauge field and the graviton.
You can't do that. That's not consistent.
No. Okay. No, that's my point. So you can write down an effective theory, and it looks perfectly fine. The four dimensional effective theory looks perfectly fine.
Oh.
But exactly the
that's
problem.
Too nice.
No, that's the point I'm trying to make. That's exactly the point that I'm saying, is that you have to make sure that you've solved those high dimensional equations.
Sure. But sometimes there are extra issues where if you dimensionally reduce the action and vary it, you don't get all of the, you know, there's some missing equations of motion. I mistakenly thought that this was the kind of issue.
That's not the case.
Those
types of exotic compactification are not the one I'm writing down. I'm interested. Yeah.
You just make sure that you don't freeze out some.
That's right.
Some degrees of freedom that need to be there to solve the equation.
That's right. Essentially, the statement is, you know, you should do dimensional reduction correctly.
Yeah.
And that's not a deep statement. Right. But what I'm trying to tell you, or trying to give a story on, is how to do it in some specific backgrounds and what this might look like outside of the usual Kaluza-Klein story. Okay. Good. Okay. So, Nanesh asked about this, so it was indeed in the next slide. What does the effective kinetic term look like? And indeed, it's a combination of what you would have expected for the volume modulus, and what you would have expected for the dilaton. So you have a gravity piece and a dilaton piece. It's not particularly enlightening to look at this, but nonetheless, just to prove that it can be done, you can write down this effective action, then here it is. So you should immediately recognize this, say that talking squarely in cheek, that this is the kinetic term for the usual volume modulus. I say immediately, I don't necessarily mean that. When you have P plus 1 and D, it's not clear that this is what you should have. But this is indeed exactly what you would have had in the unwarped case for a volume modulus. And I guess take my word on that one. The dilaton kinetic term is not as intuitive or nice looking, but nonetheless, you can write it down, and there it is. And the true kinetic term is some combination of these two, is the mixture of these two. So the effective theory is very different than what it would have looked like if you had just studied each as an independent degree of freedom. So if you're interested in studying things like De Sitter space, well, De Sitter space is about vacua, so maybe you don't care as much about what the specific kinetic term looks like, but you will care about what the degrees of freedom are. Or if you're interested in studying something like inflation on one of these spaces, this is very important. You need to know what the kinetic terms are in order to know anything about the theory. So these dynamical questions are extremely important. Okay. Good. So let me talk about two little side issues, namely that I can't take the weakly warped limit. It's not the same as doing the... Well, I can take the weakly warped limit, but it's not the same as the unwarped limit. And also give some other examples of where this might appear. So let me take this background that I had and take a weakly warped limit. So I had this background where I had a warp factor, and I had a dilaton, which both depended on y. And so let me take this warp factor to go as epsilon times some function of y, where epsilon is some small parameter. Usually it ends up being inversely related to the volume. So if you go to the large volume limit, epsilon becomes small and smaller. Okay. So in the small epsilon limit at leading order in epsilon, this warp factor e to the 2a x of y goes like this, linear order in the fluctuation, linear order in epsilon. Gamma here is just some number. Same thing with the dilaton fluctuation. I can take a small epsilon limit where I get a background and a fluctuation. A background is linear in epsilon times some function on y and some coefficients. Okay. So the question is, as I take this weakly warped limit, is there some point at which I can take these dilaton and volume modulus fluctuations to now be independent? In completely unwarped space, I know that I have two separate degrees of freedom. I have a volume modulus, and I have a dilaton that I can fluctuate independently of each other. I don't have these mixing issues, and I don't have the same issues with solving the constraint equations. Excuse me. So the question is, can I do that as I move in that direction towards the weakly warp limit? I take this warp factor to be small. And the answer ends up being no. And one way to see that is the following. So I have to solve these constraint equations. These are the essential things. So I have a constraint equation, which must be zero, which schematically looks something like this. Absolutely.
So we are all the way through talking about
the static solution of these, because I mean, you say you take your G plus one dimension to be either Minkowski or de Sitter. So that means there is no evolution. There's no time dependence.
That's right. I'm just studying fluctuations about a vacuum solution.
The fluctuations can be time dependent.
The fluctuations are time dependent. Absolutely. Absolutely. Whenever I'm writing this, so X is space time dependent.
Yeah.
That's right. Fluctuations are space time dependent, but I have a static background. Now, the next step, as you have already kind of guessed, is I would also like to put this on a non-static background, like cosmological background. But already I should try and understand what happens with the static background and the space time dependent fluctuation.
I mean, the thing I keep worrying about is that here you have all these d mu's, partial mu's, and they are partial derivatives, not covariant derivatives.
This is a scalar field, right? So the difference doesn't matter.
This has no
indices.
You're right. I was thinking about your four metric that you had before. But I mean, you're saying...
Oh, no, so that, I think I covariantized it correctly.
Yeah.
No, I wanted this one.
Okay.
Or rather, this on Zatz. Okay, so there's one here that's not quite covariantized. I covariantized here whenever I wrote down my metric on Zatz. I don't know if this is what you're concerned about.
Yeah, that's what I was
wondering. Yeah, yeah.
These are all supposed to be covariant.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah, this one should be covariantized.
Yeah, but I suppose it doesn't matter because these are first order variables, so like if the difference between covariant, I mean, if you're perturbing around Minkowski, then
it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Clearly. Okay. But if you're doing anti-de-Sitter or de-Sitter. Well, okay, so this one it also clearly doesn't matter. I guess you could ask whether it should matter here.
Okay, well thanks.
Yeah. Good. Okay. So here we were.
Could I ask something? But did you say that the strictly unwarped thing is a kind of singular limit, that it has a different number
of
freedom than the
slightly
warped?
So I'm going to explain what I mean by that just right now. So indeed, let me take the weakly warped limit, where epsilon is not equal to zero, and try and solve this equation. The only way I can solve this equation, well, this is order epsilon, and this is order epsilon. But there's no terms at zeroth order in epsilon. So everything is first order in epsilon, and so epsilon drops out. It's valid at all orders of epsilon, whenever epsilon is not equal to zero. And so in order to solve this equation, this degree of freedom, u of x, which was controlling my warp factors in my metric, and this degree of freedom, which was controlling my fluctuations in the dilaton, have to be identified. It's the only way I can solve this equation. Have to be the same degree of freedom. Now, it's not true at epsilon equal to zero. Epsilon equal to zero, now I have no equation here that needs to be solved.
Well, in writing down these kinds of equations, if I wrote down the full equations in a detailed theory, I'd worry about, you haven't written down anything about the background fields that are supporting the warp factor.
That's right.
So you would worry, some of us might worry,
that
when you do these distortions, you're going to distort those things as well. These things are typically, you know, fluxes over a volume, things like this.
Yeah.
So when I'm seeing these equations on the right-hand side, I'm supposed to be assuming that I can do these perturbations without disturbing those?
So the question, okay, good. So the question is, when I do that fluctuation, will that fluctuation in that field appear in the constraint equation as well? And so if you actually look at how these things tend to couple, for instance, a D-brain, oh, there's no chalk? Or, great. Thanks. Okay. So if you looked at how a D-brain might couple, you actually expect it to couple at beyond linear order. So what it, the fluctuation of the dilaton wouldn't induce a fluctuation of the D-brain, for instance. So if remember how I wrote down, let me say fluctuations of the fluxes. That's one you specifically talked about and that I wrote down. So it's something like this in the action, which means that this to be at second order in the action, then this is some background. So I actually don't, so fluctuations in the dilaton actually don't induce fluctuations in the p-form or in the fluxes at linear order. The other way is not true. Certainly fluctuations in the fluxes induce fluctuations in the dilaton.
In general, if I play with the volume modulus, mm-hmm. and if I have a knock mind and help work, I worry that that's not decoupled in the fact
that. Well, certainly in the p-brain example, you didn't need to turn on. So the fluctuation of the D-brain itself was not, didn't need to be included, and in fact decouples entirely. That's right. That's right. That's at linear order. At linear, right? At quadratic order, that's not true. At quadratic order in the equation of motion, that's not true. So actually an interesting question, which I'll say on the next slide, is what do you mean by a fluctuation of the fluxes? What do you mean by a fluctuation of, say, the D-brain. And it turns out that that's not well defined. But let me get to that in a second. But yeah.
So should we be disturbed if the number of degrees of freedom suddenly jumps?
You might be concerned, but let me give you a different example in a completely different context that might make you feel slightly more comfortable, or maybe not. So this is a classic example of Witten, where you take a circle. And on the circle, you make identifications that break supersymmetry. Now, let me take the circle to be larger and larger. At any finite value of the circle, supersymmetry is broken. If I go to the infinity, if I go to infinite volume, so the boundary of moduli space, now the boundary conditions don't exist anymore, and supersymmetry is restored.
Well, but that's a kind of singular limit even of the metric itself. Here you're just approaching smoothly. Continuously, perfectly well-defined, finite.
No, but that's not entirely true. Is there a smooth way to turn off the D-brain source?
Yeah. I don't know. There isn't,
right? You have to take a singular one.
I mean, certainly in the quantitative theory, they're quantized, so you have to go smooth a little bit. Unless you mean going far away or something like that.
So you're saying the intermediate theories don't really exist? I mean, the intermediate solutions don't really exist, is that it?
When fluxes are quantized, you can't tune it. Yeah, that's right. You could write it down in the field theory level.
So most of those things you're writing down are not physically even solutions, only for certain. Is that right?
For the p-brain example I wrote down, I didn't actually turn on quantized fluxes, so it was fine.
So
I had in mind some.
Then we could worry about it in that context.
Okay, good. So then the question is, what's the parameter you tune? It's the tension of the d-brain.
Right.
So what you have to do is you tune that tension of the D-brain to zero. When you tune the tension of the D-brain to zero, exactly zero, then there's zero warping, and you get just a standard flat space. But at any finite value of the tension, you still have warping. At any finite value of the tension, epsilon is still not zero.
Sounds like you're taking the D-brain away, so you might lose degrees of freedom. But
Then you would lose D-brain degrees of freedom in addition. Yeah. But if you take the tension to zero, then
you're saying if we counted all of the. But I'm just wondering though, could this be an example? You know, there's something called linearization instability.
Okay.
Where you have which the quadratic constraints are reminded. I mean, where you have solutions of the linearized equations that correspond to no solution of the full nonlinear Einstein equation.
Mm-hmm.
This happens commonly in. It happens in cosmological. I mean, it happens when you have Killing vectors and a compact spatial slice.
Okay.
So generically, you get these extra constraints that you have to satisfy.
Okay.
So if you just linearize, there's no dimensional reduction involved in general.
Yeah, yeah.
But you just linearize the Einstein equation, mm-hmm. and you just solve them. You make a mistake. you get spurious degrees of freedom.
Okay.
So I'm just wondering if this extra degree of freedom that's popping out.
I have a feeling it's probably
the issue
not.
And this limit is one of these spurious.
I have a feeling it's perhaps not, just because I'm not. So I don't. I'm not necessarily saying. So. Okay, let me say, in the unwarped limit, no, I know there actually are 2 degrees of freedom at the nonlinear level. I can write down I can write down the nonlinear ansatz for the Dilettante fluctuation. I know that works. So the extra degree of freedom is not spurious in that case. If you ask me what's the nonlinear version in the warped case, that's pretty hard. In some cases, I can write it down. But in most cases, I can't. I can only write down linear. But it doesn't sound like that's the case that you're referring to.
No, it would be the opposite.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. No, it seems very strange. Thank you. Okay. So let me get back to this story, though, about other degrees of freedom or other fluctuations, because this has come up a lot in the discussion. So. The story I gave you on how the Dilettante fluctuation is not a good degree of freedom and has to combine with the metric is actually a more general story. So the story I gave is you can always choose new coordinates or gauge transformations to get rid of what you thought was a fluctuation. So it's not a gauge invariant fluctuation, so it's not a good one. So I can ask a similar question about fluxes. So let me say I have fluxes, or I have some background flux. This is one of my quantized fluxes. And I have something that is an axion. So the axion is, in terms of the, so I should have written this in terms of the gauge potential where it might be more obvious. It's just a scalar field times some internal form. So this is a two-form purely on the internal space. At the level of the gauge potential, or sorry, the gauge strength, then you get dB, the exterior derivative on B, wedged with the two-form. So this is what we call an axion degree of freedom. In p-form fields. But there's a problem in that this is not actually a gauge invariant degree of freedom. You can do a gauge transformation. Let me say not gauge transformation because that may be confusing in this context. Let me say a diffeomorphism. I can form a diffeomorphism, a coordinate redefinition, xi, on the internal space that transforms f3 to something new, f3 plus some exterior derivative of something, some object. But if I choose this diffeomorphism correctly, I can always get rid of this fluctuation. So I'm left with just a background. So axions are not gauge invariant degrees of freedom. The true gauge invariant degree of freedom describing an axion fluctuation has to be a mixture between the p-form field sector and the metric sector. So I have to write down the gauge invariant degrees of freedom, figure out which ones solve the constraint equations, the same story that I gave before. So this is another example of the same general story that I just gave. The same is also true for D-brain degrees of freedom. In fact, it's perhaps even more intuitive for D-brain degrees of freedom. So let me say I have some D-brain position. So this is describing the embedding of a D-brain in my internal space. I is just the internal coordinates. So this D-brain coordinate position or embedding coordinate can depend on space-time. And let me just take it to be fixed. So Z0 plus some fluctuation, delta Z. But I can always choose new coordinates. So I have this space-time, or I have this membrane, which is fluctuating in space-time. But I can always choose new internal coordinates that trace out that membrane in the appropriate way that now it doesn't fluctuate in the new coordinate system. So I can always choose a new gauge, or a new coordinate system, make a diffeomorphism, to absorb this, and we're just left with a fixed brain in the new coordinate system.
When you write the effective filter, you should pair up with the volume modulus, or?
They pair up, but they're separate degrees of freedom.
Okay, so that I was just confused a bit. The pairing is not.
The pairing is unrelated. So that pairing is motivated more by arguments of supersymmetry and constructing the appropriate holomorphic variables. It doesn't seem to have a nice analog. This doesn't seem to connect.
It's unrelated.
Yeah, that's right. So brain coordinates are not good degrees of freedom. And this is even weirder, though, because it means that the open string degrees of freedom, if we're talking in a string theory context now, the open string degrees of freedom have to mix with the closed string degrees of freedom to create a true independent gauge invariant degree of freedom in my lower dimensional theory. And that sounds really strange. But nonetheless, I mean, you can always gauge the way, you can check the constraint equations for something like this, and you'll find that they're not satisfied. So you can't just turn on a brain and fluctuate it. It just doesn't. That doesn't make any sense. So what are their effective theory? I don't know. It's tricky to write down the onsets for this and solve the system, but this is currently what we're doing. Trying to figure out what really are d-brain degrees of freedom? What really are axiom degrees of freedom? Essentially, we're trying to reinvent everything that we thought we knew and really understand them in a true gauge invariant language. Okay, so now let me, in the last few minutes, speculate a little bit about some cosmological applications of these ideas.
So are you saying people are making errors when they...
You caught the subtext. Yeah. This is a standard thing. You just turn on d-brain fluctuation. The effective action for that d-brain fluctuation is given by the dBi action. End story. What's usually done. What I'm saying is that doesn't actually make sense. And in fact, I can give you a specific example if you want to talk about it afterwards, where we think we know what the four-dimensional effective theory is, but you can't derive that from a dimensional reduction if you just do this. It's one of these mysteries. Well, not that deep of a mystery, but it's one of these puzzles where these extra terms in the kinetic terms are coming from. It's not a mystery. You didn't include all the correct fluctuations.
So you're saying the dBi action is not correct, or?
I'm saying the dBi action is not sufficient.
What else is there?
So you have to include fluctuations additional in metric that are corresponding to d-brain fluctuations. Mm-hmm. And these fluctuations will then, through the Ricci scalar, give additional kinetic terms. Mm-hmm.
So are the number of degrees of freedom more in the dBi action, or?
So in this case, it seems like the degrees of freedom are the same, and in fact, there's no parameter that I'm tuning in a similar way. For instance, for a d-brain, if the d-brain is either there or it's not. It's not. I didn't actually rely on warping at all here. Just there was a d-brain or there wasn't. So it's an even simpler story than that. So the degrees of freedom end up being there's only d-brain degrees of freedom in that case. It just happens that the d-brain degrees of freedom also end up fluctuating components of the metric.
So the effective potential is different.
The effective potential is different. The effective kinetic term is different. Right.
So how does it look like? Does it mean that when I do dBi inflation, I should use a different kinetic term, or is that?
So dBi inflation is even a little bit crazier because you're beyond linear order. I don't know how to go beyond linear order in the kinetic terms.
Yeah.
So actually, it would be very interesting to see what dBi inflation would look like. I would say that the dBi action, the standard dBi action, square root of 1 minus d phi squared, is not going to be the only kinetic term. And in fact, this isn't a new statement. You expect back reaction already. But now I'm just saying that it's already at the level of dynamics. It's not a potential back reaction. It's a kinetic back reaction. So yeah, that action will change, absolutely.
There's some part of the logic that I'm confused about here.
Yes.
You're making the statement based on the classical supergravity action?
Which statement?
This
I'm just saying
saying I do the fluctuations, I look at the classical constraint, and I get a problem. Yes?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, the confusion is I would normally say to describe a d-brain in a supergravity limit, I'm actually needing to talk about a p-brain. In which case, the only one which isn't singular is the three-brain, in which case I don't have these issues.
No, okay.
So what do we do?
No, what I'm talking about is a d-brain. Right, so I'm talking about a string theory object. So this I specifically didn't say p-brain, I meant a Dirichlet brain. So it actually has degrees of freedom. It is some well-defined object in string theory that has a dBi action which describes it. Certainly.
When you're talking about dBi action with a fixed background, sure, that's I think no one would know how to describe it in that moment.
That's right. So, but it's certainly true that if you were to go close enough to the D-brain for D not equal to 3, then you should expect something to go wrong, the supergravity description of this D-brain to go wrong. And in fact, you should expect streaming corrections to come in. But I mean, what I'm saying is just the usual words that people say about that, right? You don't know what the, you know, we don't know what the streaming corrections actually are going to do to resolve the singularity there, but we expect there will be streaming corrections.
I certainly agree with that.
Good.
I mean, could you just view this purely as a supergravity question? I mean, just a 10-dimensional supergravity solution to 10-dimensional supergravity?
Not this. This is a string theory question. You could talk about it at this level. This is just purely supergravity, yeah. That's fine. You have fluxes in type 2B supergravity, and that's... these things make perfect sense. And there you still have the problem with axions. I mean, D-brains are inherent to string theory objects, right? So I have something particular in mind when I'm talking about this. Okay, great. So let me speculate a little bit. So what does cosmology look like with extra dimensions? Well, a standard story about how cosmology would look with extra dimensions is I have some internal or some external space, four-dimensional space, and some internal space. Let me take it to be negatively curved. So it's like a torus with many handles. And I have a volume modulus that I'll keep track of. I'm going to call it psi. So if I do the dimensional reduction on this space, there's no warp factors. The dimensional reduction is perfectly well-defined, describing it this way. My d-dimensional action becomes a four-dimensional effective action, a four-dimensional Ricci scalar, kinetic term, and effective potential for this field psi, which looks something like this. So graphically, the effective potential looks like this. It's an exponential, or rather a 1 over, an exponential one in the variable psi. And I can ask about cosmologies. So I can take this space to be cosmological. And so I get a cosmological background that looks something like this. And in particular, you can take your scalar field, take it to be homogeneous and flick it up this potential, and then it rolls back down. And at the point of turnaround, it's effectively not moving. It has no kinetic energy, but it has potential energy. You get acceleration, transient acceleration, order of QE folds. Not that good for inflation. And in fact, this ends up not being even very good for dark energy. But nonetheless, it's a toy cosmology. You can ask these types of questions. So this is what a standard cosmology might look like with extra dimensions. So this is an old story going back, 10 years. I'm not saying anything new here. Okay. So this is what a nice cosmology might look like with extra dimensions. Now let me throw in what the warp factor, so the warp factor, what it might do. So it might play some role like this. But the ansatzes I wrote down before for warp perturbation theory, when you have time dependence and internal space dependence, is actually much more intricate. So what you might get is something that looks more like this. So you have a warp factor which depends on both time and internal space. You have some piece in front of the time metric which depends on both time and internal space. You have some mixing term between time and internal space. And you have, again, a warp factor here, and then you have your usual scale factor here. But this is a very different picture of cosmology and extra dimensions than this picture. So one way it could be very different is just as a cartoon. Wherever you are in the internal space, you can get a different cosmology because these numbers, which tell you what the effect of cosmology are, A, E, and K, are different at different points in the internal space. They have Y dependence. So you could be at one point of the internal space and you're living on Minkowski. You could be at another point in the internal space and you're living in de Sitter space. Very strange. Now, of course, there's also an effective If you were to average over the internal space, there's also an average cosmology that one would see. But what do we actually do when we do models with extra dimensions? You typically have fields localized or even spread out in the extra dimensions. So, I mean, what does this mean for cosmologies when you have fields that are different points in the internal space, but they have slightly different cosmologies? It's not really even clear if it makes sense at this point. Whether that can be made consistent with what we know of as cosmology. But the point is that this is very different from a standard four-dimensional effective cosmology. We're not doing just studying inflationary models now. We're looking at something very different. So this is a glimpse into what I would like to think about a little bit more in the future about whether these types of questions make sense. So I haven't told you. I'm not giving you a solution. I'm giving you a picture. So certainly something should stabilize the internal directions, or the internal dimensions. Otherwise, it's a runaway. Absolutely.
I mean, so when you go to the nonlinear theory, why should we think that this warping ansatz is even a solution of the...
The warping ansatz as a background, so you would hope that it solves the Einstein equations. You hope that the background solves the Einstein equations. If it doesn't, then what are you doing?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, the background usually doesn't.
The background does not solve the Einstein equations?
Usually we need quantum ingredients, especially to make things for... things that are at all cosmological, we need a variety of quantum ingredients to make these things.
Yeah, that's very unsatisfying. It makes you this is another one of the directions that I've been interested in recently. It makes you wonder whether that solution actually exists. But let me summarize, because I think we're at the end of our time here, so we can continue with conversations later. So I described a story on how we should understand theories with extra dimensions and how we should understand their degrees of freedom. Give you the standard story. Well, we start with higher dimensions. We compactify and study in four dimensions. But this can miss some things, some very important things, including things that tell us about what the number of degrees of freedom are. The question, or what I told you about, is how you need to solve the constraint equations in the internal diffeomorphisms. But then I also wanted to paint a picture more generally of studying things at the level of the higher dimensions, something that's inherently higher dimensional that we can't mock up with some four-dimensional effective theory. So some new direction of studying things with extra dimensions. And so that's something that I'm interested in. And then the main points that I tried to get across was this is very similar to cosmological perturbation theory, and you find that fluctuations combine in ways that you maybe wouldn't have expected, particularly with the dual-time fluctuation and the volume modulus into this breathing mode. And cosmology may look very different in this picture than what we normally expect. So that's it. Thank you. Further questions?
This last point about cosmology looking very different at different points.
Yes.
Isn't that somehow, I mean, to have a four-dimensional effective theory at all, you're somehow assuming that the compact dimensions are small.
Small enough.
So if its cosmology is very different, can they remain small? I mean, if one is expanding and one is not expanding or something like that, can the...
Well, I don't see what the problem is.
Dynamically going to allow the internal dimensions to remain small? What does that even mean exactly? I mean, you have because you.
I knew,
small means approximately a product of some four-dimensional metric.
No, so small means that if from the four-dimensional point of view, I can't probe it.
That's what we mean by small. Geometrically, what does small actually mean? If it doesn't.
Sorry, I don't necessarily mean geometrically small. It's geometrically compact. When you say something is that you have extra dimensions, but they're small, what do you mean by small? It means small enough that we haven't seen it, right?
No, I'm just saying, how would you even, if someone showed you the metric, how would you know whether the extra dimensions are small? I think it's the same question you're raising.
No, you can.
I'm just wondering whether.
No, what you would need, okay, so the question you should ask in that context is, what is the spectrum of Kaluza-Klein modes? Okay, if the spectrum of Kaluza-Klein modes has modes with masses sufficiently low that we should have already seen them in colliders, for instance, then that's not small enough. That's
right, but how would you identify the Kaluza-Klein mode?
Through exactly the same procedure that I went through. So you take fluctuations, and now you look at fluctuations which have non-trivial momentum, now generalized momentum in the internal space. So Kaluza-Klein modes, so standard Kaluza-Klein modes in...
You won't have any with zero momentum in the internal space. If your internal space... metric is changing radically from one point in the internal space to another point in the internal space.
Yeah, I mean, what is, yeah. So,
that's another way of saying.
Exactly. Well, okay, good. So then your cool decline mode may be time dependent. I don't know. These are the types of questions that I think are interesting to ask. And I don't think these types of questions have been asked. And it looks like it's a very different picture than what we're used to. So I agree with the same conclusions.
One question? Thank you very much.
Thank you.